Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to the A24 project here on the Nerd Party Network. We've dived into the filmography of A24 and we'll bring you reviews as the films land and hopefully continue to bring you interviews with talent in front of and behind the camera. But this week we're doing something a little bit different and diving into the marketing behind A24 with marketing specialist and podcaster Anton Volkov. Anton, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, so obviously before we dive into discussing the kind of marketing of A24, it's no doubt people maybe follow you on Twitter that are listening to this or listen to your own podcast. Can you tell people a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. I've been running a website called Trailer Tracker now for the past just over four years now. And I've followed kind of the marketing side of the film for a very long time. I'm in the middle of my final year doing a master's on this very subject, film marketing and distribution, at the National Film and Television School just outside of London. And so for me, kind of this world is something that fascinated me for a very long time. And I'm, you know, hopefully trying to turn this into kind of a more of a real life thing rather than just, you know, following it as a fan, as fun as it is. And that's the thing about this way, when you love doing something like this or following something like this, you know, if you end up doing it for real and engaging with the industry for real, that just makes it even more rewarding. And as you mentioned, I did end up starting my own podcast on Trailer Track itself. It's called The Inside Track. And the idea behind that is because the MO of Trailer Track is to talk about trailers when brand new anticipated looks at various films, including A24 titles, are coming out. That's really the MO of the site, but the podcast gives me a bit more space to go a bit outside of the website's MO to talk about things like what's actually happening in the industry or reviews of films, like for instance when London Film Festival is going to happen in a couple of weeks' time. And so yeah, it's kind of a new thing for me, podcasts. And it's been a fun one.
Yeah, so before we sort of dive into A24 and their marketing and branding, I want to get what's your opinion on sort of A24 as a sort of film fan, and what are some of the highlights of their filmography for you, Anton?
I mean, A24, they really are kind of the probably the definitive in terms of, you know, branding, people being aware of them, the definitive, you know, American independent brand, the studio or distributor. They're not among the major studios, but people know them, and that's the exciting thing about them. It is normally, you know, now in this age of mega franchises, you know, think Marvel, Star Wars, and James Bond, and so on. It's nice to see, something on the independent side, which is an entirely different side of the industry compared to the studio system, thrive so much that it does have almost its own audience. Like people coming out for A24 films specifically, people engaging with the distributor itself. And so that's been a fascinating thing to follow over the last few years. And part of that is because they have some fantastic films. I mean, so some of my, the ones that really come to mind that I really, really enjoyed. Most recently, Uncut Gems was one. A Ghost Story is another absolutely beautiful one. First Reformed. It's that combination of kind of the auto drive and also having a distinctive vision that is both on the film side, like they deliver some and help bring, because you've got to remember, they're not just a production company and they only recently started to get into production. They are primarily a distributor. They pick up rights in the US to certain films and then bring them and brand them to audiences there. And the way that they do that, it's part of why they've become such a recognizable, you know, brand in the film world, is that they do it in their own way that is just distinctive. It's almost in a way that you used to see from some of the big studios, you know, think, you know, the middle of the 20th century when the studio system was really starting up. You know, Warner Brothers had a certain, like, darker brand to it. MGM had musicals. And to have something that replicates that in a certain degree in today's world while everyone's gone to superheroes and franchises is nice.
What's your kind of opinion, sort of, from the outside, as sort of like, you know, you're studying kind of marketing. What's your thoughts on, in sort of 2020, A24 as a brand? We'll obviously dive kind of into the start of it kind of shortly. But at this kind of moment in time, what's your feeling on them as a brand that they've spent sort of the past kind of 5-6 years kind of developing?
They, as I said, I think they are probably the most recognizable American indie brand for film, and that's one of the unbelievable achievements that they've had, is the fact that they have managed to develop this brand to the point of, when you do have a film released in the UK that A24 happens to have distribution rights in America, we immediately, among the film community, and also, some, whether that carries over to the general public is another question that we don't really know the answer to. But the impression is people always refer to that film as an A24 film, because it's the way that they put their brand on it, they put their stamp on it, that everyone who's working with that film across the world happily takes, even though that, essentially when they're doing this stuff, they're working for the US market primarily.
Obviously, they had a kind of few films before it kind of came along with Spring Breakers, which really sort of heralded the start of A24 with their marketing and sort of unique branding. Do you sort of remember sort of that blitz at the time when Spring Breakers kind of came along?
I admittedly wasn't following it that much at the time, but it is a that early slate of films, Spring Breakers, Bling Ring. I was looking back at those over the last couple of years, just to see where they've come from, and what they've established, I think, is a very distinctive style and approach, partly because of what these early films were and how very similar they were stylistically. When we think of independent film, we think of something that's more prestige, more dramatic, more aimed at older audiences. But then when you look at the trailers for, Spring Breakers, there's a certain freshness to it. There's a certain youthfulness to it going that's aimed towards a younger audience, and evidently succeeded at getting a younger audience to engage with independent film. And so that's and it's interesting in a way, that's what has defined A24, is that youthful energy to it. Where that comes from is a whole other question. Is that because you've got fashion brands who market in a similar way that A24 decided to apply to film. But again, as I said, it just comes back to that energy that you don't get, or at least I don't think you did. You could get that at that time, thinking early 2010s from the independent sector.
Obviously, that Red Band trailer for Spring Breakers stood out for a lot of people. What are some of your kind of favorite A24 trailers, and is there any that sort of specifically stand out for you in terms of how they're kind of marketed?
Great question. I think when it starts to become really interesting is when A24 started, having more actual films that they produced themselves that they then manage across the world and end up having a hand in the way that they're released across the world. And we've only really kind of seen that in the last, three, 4 years. Stuff like Eighth Grade, right through to most recently Uncut Gems, although that was a Netflix title outside of the US. That was still very much managed by A24. You've got The Green Knight, and the ones that it's almost ironic that they're some of the most recent ones, but there's something in the way that Uncut Gems trailer's cut, and that's, if there's one trailer I could pick out of, all the A24 trailers I've seen and followed over the years, actually there's two. Moonlight is another one. And I guess the success that film has had just goes to show how well that campaign worked and how beautifully they managed to coalesce the three timelines just together and add the score in from the film. For me, what makes a great trailer is when you have the score from the film. And so it's almost direct opposites, but for me, yeah, the two trailers that I really love from their filmography are Moonlight and Uncut Gems. Again, it just has a certain energy to it. Although with Moonlight, it's more of a dramatic film and it leans more into the drama, but it still comes back to the youthful energy that I mentioned before, and the fact that they're able to take some swings in a way that we don't really see among the studios, we don't really see among the more the prestige independent side, aside from, think, Fox Searchlight and so on. But going to Uncut Gems, it's the music. For me, the key to great trailers is to have great music, and the way that they take that track from Travis Scott in The Weeknd, and I think it's worth shouting out the agency that cut that piece, Grandson, over in LA. They did such an amazing job just getting the rhythm and capturing, and I think many of 2024's great trailers do that, capturing the vision, the tone, the pace that the filmmakers themselves have set, in this case the Safdies, and you can see that as well in their campaign for Good Time. It is all about that energy, and it's the blend of that energy working for the particular audience that they're aiming for. And because A24 has so many films that are aimed at slightly different audiences than you'd expect, so yeah, that it's just this mix of things that makes those particular pieces really work for me. Sorry if I just slightly went on a tangent there.
No, our tangents are always encouraged. I'm curious, you obviously touched on you are studying kind of marketing. Is A24 sort of their marketing sort of part of the curriculum, or could you see something like that happening kind of down the line potentially?
It's hard to say because we're very much studying it from a UK perspective, and since A24, as I mentioned, they primarily deal with the US. They don't distribute their films directly outside of America, like here in the UK. So, but they have become, I think, the poster child of the way that you attach a brand to a distributor, because as I said before, you don't really kind of get that association today, except for, we're talking about the franchise. It's all about the content, it's all about the films, it's all about what franchises you have. The fact that, A24 has this, very playful social media presence, or they have a merchandise store. Like, would you think Warner Brothers having a merchandise store? I mean, Disney, that's a whole other thing. But A24 has that. In a way that, Neon doesn't, Fox Searchlight doesn't, smaller distributors. I mean, here, trying to think on a UK perspective, what's the closest that comes to this sort of brand? Probably
Maybe
Curzon.
Focus? Yeah, Curzon, that's
Yeah,
a good shout.
Curzon. I mean, a Focus is a slight cheat to mention, along with Searchlight, because they are, parts of major studios. Focus, in this case, Universal Pictures. And it's worth mentioning Universal Pictures because they actually release many of A24's films internationally and here in the UK. And the fact that, at this point, many of their films do command major studio attention and get the likes of Universal to bring those films to audiences around the world, that just goes to show how far they must have come.
Yeah, it's one of those ones. It is quite amazing when you think of it. Like, as you say, they are by and large an American distributor, but obviously in the past few years, obviously starting with The Lovers to things like kind of Lady Bird, Midsommar, Hereditary, etc. They've had some of these standout films where you will see the A24 logo at the start of films, but for nearly 100 odd films, and obviously, and I do find it bizarre as well, the Apple movies don't come with the A24 logo at the start. Even if you see an A24 movie like Boy State, which was part of this A24 Apple TV partnership, it doesn't have the A24 logo at the start of the film worldwide, even though you get kind of the trailer with it. It's interesting how they've managed to become that worldwide brand for something that only ever really releases in America, and then sort of maybe once or twice a year, kind of around the world. It's quite incredible how they've managed to do that for what is essentially a distribution company.
Yeah, and I think it's worth noting, just as an example of how far the brand's gone, if you've seen here in the UK the films that entertainment film distributors released here that were released by A24 in the States, so really it's, Hereditary, Midsommar, The Farewell. If you look at all their marketing materials, especially the trailers, all they have is the A24 logo on them. Like, they are branded as the A24 films here in the UK without even a mention of, oh, there's actually another company that's releasing this film over here. And the fact that they have that power, the fact that, sure, something like, Uncut Gems, that's sold off to a massive brand like Netflix outside of the United States. And yet, you know, when you're seeing it either on Netflix or there were screenings just at the end of last year, obviously LFF, it was a surprise film, but and the start of this year, you had the A24 logo on there. It's, you know, the power that they command now is very, very notable, and even on a global scale like this. And I think part of that just comes down to the people being aware of their films, being aware of their brand. But what has also helped, I think, is them getting into the production side of it and, you know, handling those films. Because just to get into a little, you know, inside baseball, the way that on the independent market films are sold is that they go to festivals, you know, like Sundance, Toronto, Berlin, Cannes, and then they're sold from country to country. And basically, what A24 does now with the films that they end up producing is they manage the sales on that film. So that allows them to have the sort of control that they do, although they're not actually going to be releasing these films outside of the US. But at the same time, you know, when they do pick up a film that they pick up just the US rights for, and I was just trying to see if there was a kind of list something to refer back to, and the first example that popped to mind, I think First Reformed. Well, what was that one? Was that the one of the ones that was just where they had the US, where they purchased the US on, and they didn't even, it's not their own production.
Yeah, I just purchased the US one, yeah.
So something like that, right? They even then, the materials that A24 create for the US, and that the same ends up applying to a lot of independent distributors. Whoever has the US distribution holds a lot of power in terms of generating buzz. Like if it's got a good US distributor, it's likely to do particularly well when you're releasing it in the UK or elsewhere. But also the US distributor, partly because, you know, they probably have more money, they do the trailers, they do the posters, and then you get all these other distributors around the world who are just like, well, that works for us, so we're just going to take it. And it's fascinating the way that with A24, you know, you'd think that it's a bit of an afterthought, the international market, but then somehow what they do works, you know, wherever. And that's part of why, again, to kind of come back to the brand that they've established, it's part of why that works, because whenever A24 drops a trailer for a film like Midsommar, you see it everywhere, and then everyone ends up using it. There's this coordination amongst the distributors, and it just hammers home the message and what they're presenting the film as on a level that we really kind of only see amongst the major studios that have all the money in the world, obviously COVID notwithstanding, to have, you know, global theatrical rollouts.
How, obviously this is your area of expertise, how rare is something like that, that an American distributor can impact the marketing campaigns of a film that's getting released in Australia, Russia, the UK, for example, if it's been released by Universal or whoever? Is that common? Is that rare, you know, to have that sort of synchronized campaign?
I think to the level that A24 has, it happens less often. I would say it's more hap or almost just a matter of almost coincidence and timings and circumstance that are just sometimes easier for a lot of these companies who, you know, might not have the money to go out and hire an agency to cut a trailer. You know, most of the time they may end up doing their own poster for the UK or elsewhere, but. And so, but then they just for the trailer go, yeah, it's going to be easier to just use the US one. So the power that the US distributors have, that's not rare, as I mentioned before. But the sort of branded coordination, I think that's fairly unique to the likes of A24 or the likes of Neon, because of how powerful those brands are and recognizable those brands are in their own right.
One thing you touched on there is obviously we are speaking during sort of a COVID lockdown. I mean, A24 films have basically been wiped off the map. First Cow had a very limited release in sort of the East and West Coast of America before being sort of pulled, and it eventually ended up on VOD. The Green Knight, which I know we're both excited for, no word on that being released, and kind of various other kind of films. What's the kind of future for something like A24? Because they seem determined they want to release these films in cinemas or potentially drive-ins, for example. They seem to be holding off, you know, the pressure to release a Green Knight onto VOD. And, you know, you're someone that speaks quite passionately about the drive-in experience. I mean, I don't know if you remember, obviously A24 a year or two ago did the A24 public
access those billboards. Screenings.
Yeah, so they had Lady Bird, The Bling Ring, The Witch, Good Time, Spectacular Now, and Moonlight, where they projected the film onto billboards, limited tickets, they were made events, you had t-shirts, marketing, etc. Do you think we could see the potential return of something like that for A24? Not necessarily maybe doing their new films, but do you think they'll eventually embrace maybe having to release things into American kind of drive-ins? Because it certainly looks like at the moment America is not going to be kind of going very far into kind of cinema releases for quite a while maybe the rest of the world continues on.
I mean, it's worth I think it's worth noting that unlike, you know, the debate that is happening right now over, and, you know, by the time people might be listening to this, where there may already be a solution or not, days changing for something like, you know, Black Widow, No Time to Die, just off the back of what's happened with Tenet these last few weeks, because A24 don't release those films themselves, they don't have to worry about releasing those films themselves around the world, they're just, you know, focused on the US market. I'm sure they, you know, acting as a sales agent for these films means that you do have a bit of input into the way that they're brought to market in other countries. But the reason why it's called the independent space is that, you know, everyone does their own thing. Each country does their own thing. That's the way it works. So, you know, for instance, take St. Maud. Like, that's being released here in the UK by Studio Canal. Interestingly enough, I was... the A24 logo, although, you know, a lot of people, particularly obviously in the US, but you know, the way that film's being positioned is, you know, something along the lines of Midsommar Hereditary. It's among that stable of A24 horrors because of the way that A24 has only picked up the US rights on that, and Studio Canal has the UK, Sony Pictures has the rest of the world, most of the rest of the world. You know, it's a very separate thing, and just using that example, they can, you know, that's going to be coming out in time for Halloween here in the UK, while in the US they can wait for, you know, as long as necessarily. They don't have to worry in the way that, for instance, something like No Time to Die does, because what a lot of major studios are facing right now after what happened with Tenet, which is performed really badly in the US. Although granted, in the US, you know, you've got 25-30% of cinemas still not being open, particularly in New York and much of California, including Los Angeles. The rest of the world has performed very well, and for massive film like, you know, Wonder Woman 1984, which, you know, got delayed from October to Christmas, you have to coordinate a global release. You have to make sure that's coming out in every country at the same time because of piracy, because you want to hit with the marketing at the same time. A24, although as much as, you know, we might want the independent world to, you know, get on board, you know, let's release those films at the same time because everyone's seeing the marketing, particularly the US-driven marketing from A24 for a film like St. Maud, you know, before you know, Studio Canal may kickstart marketing. Now is the time where companies like A24 can, you know, they don't have to, they just don't have to worry, I think, when it comes down to it. Whether they, in the United States specifically, end up going to drive-ins the way that Neon, for instance, is very much committed to, it depends a lot on, I guess, how they view and the traditional theatrical business and exhibitors, you know, cinemas themselves, like. And because that's politics, that a lot of politics goes into that. If people might remember, there was this story a few weeks ago about Tenet that it wasn't going to open in drive-ins in states in the US where indoor cinemas are still closed down. And the reason for that, although officially in inverted commas in Variety and so on, they said, oh, it's because of spoilers and what have you. No, the real reason, which makes sense that be the reason, is they didn't want to upset the indoor cinemas, you know, the likes of AMC, Regal, smaller independent cinemas that are still closed down, by giving drive-ins a several week, if not month long head start on those films. Now, someone on the scale of A24, I mean, Neon's been very keen to kind of work both ways and take chances on, you know, what the state of the US is going to be. Like, they've made a big deal about drive-ins for Possessor, for instance, Brandon Cronenberg's horror film from Sundance, starring Andrea Riseborough and Christopher Abbott. Now, that's going to be in drive-ins along with indoor cinemas, with a potential, you know, shortened VOD date, although that's all to be confirmed. Ammonite is another one from Neon that they've committed to traditional theatrical for. But, again, I think those companies, what it comes down to is that they don't have to worry about what if the rest of the world goes first. I mean, it would be frustrating, like, if people could, from their perspective, of course, if people could, you know, for instance, if it takes ages for St. Maud to come out here in the UK, to come out in the US, and while it comes out here, it's planned in October. If, you know, if it's not here by early 21 and it's out in the UK on iTunes or Blu-ray, that people will just end up importing that. But then that's feels like something that the independent side ends up almost accepting anyway. Otherwise, they would have done day and date. So there's that, and the fact that we've had radio silence really on what's happening with St. Maud in the US. What's happening with Zola, for instance, that's another one that they kind of quietly started marketing for, but that doesn't have a release date yet. And what's going to happen with those films?
It had that annoying tease at the end where I thought it was about to announce that it was going to be released on demand, where it was like coming soon, and then it kind of, I can't remember how it worded it exactly, was like coming soon, and then it was like coming next, and then deleted, then coming soon. It had this really weird wording at the end where it certainly got my hopes and expectations.
Yeah, and you know what, you know, that Zola teaser is a perfect example of, you know, this is what someone like A24 with a voice, you know, the shipster with a voice like A24, and is willing to take creative risks to get those films out there, can do. You know, because, you know, when you don't have a massive amount of money to work with in the way that a major studio does, you know, making materials that stand out artistically and play around a bit like this and are self-aware to a certain degree. And that's the nice thing about A24, which then, you know, we've seen likes of Amazon model themselves on that approach, Netflix model themselves on that, you know, self-aware, you know, social media friendly approach. They can do that. They can do that while major studios, they've moved away from teaser trailers like entirely. They have very stuffy corporate presences for their films on social media and in just the messaging in the way that it's marketed. So that's another thing why 24 is just so great, and they've become, you know, such a powerhouse within the independent sector. But coming back to, you know, the release dates, obviously the Green Knight is another one, like whether we're gonna get anything. But if you look back at the initial announcement that was made for First Cow earlier this year, that they were gonna wait until, you know, cinemas are back open, and sure, they went back on that and just like, okay, we're just gonna drop it on VOD, and rather than try and re-release it necessarily. I think the fact that I already played a bit in New York and LA ended up playing into that a lot. And I think what it comes down to as well is that when you start marketing for a film like The Green Knight, you only have a teaser trailer. That's different from when you have an actual film that's almost ready to be released, or, you know, has already released. And so it's not that much of a problem when you have, you know, sort of pent up demand that you have to rush the film to market like as soon as possible. And so, yeah, I personally, if I have to guess, I think they're just going to keep waiting. It seems like, as they said back with the First Cow statement, that they're committed to theatrical, and certainly their actions have been that they are committing to cinemas and releasing their films in cinemas, and that's something that even producers of films like, say Maud, or directors like David Lowery, as you interviewed him on your podcast, where he discussed that they very much support the theatrical experience. And so, if they can afford to wait, they will wait, and they just don't have to worry about, just pressure from audiences in a way that, everyone else arguably does.
What did you think of the A24 All Access, kind of these billboard kind of screenings that they did? We had like the geo coordinates to get people kind of hyped up for it. Then these sorts of, it wasn't sort of huge events and so on. It was quite relatively intimate, maybe probably about 100 people at each of these kind of locations, outside a mini mart or kind of in the middle of a field. What did you make of sort of that campaign and that sort of, I suppose it was the kind of first big kind of studio in a little while, really, to sort of focus on, outdoor drive-in sort of screenings, obviously without the car element.
I mean, it's a conversation starter, right? And that's the thing about stunts like this, that they work and that they generate conversations for a film, or in this case, a distributor. Oh, A24 is doing these billboard screenings. I'm just curious, because I'm just trying to remember. How did they do the audio for those, or did they just have them as silent
That
films?
I'm not too sure. I think it was one of those ones. I think they had probably like speaker systems they projected onto, as I say, sort of, I think it was billboards, and I think they probably had like speaker systems kind of dotted
So
around
it's
them.
essentially
I
a
don't.
bigger outdoor cinema thing. Yeah, that's nice, but specific, and especially because they're free, right? If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it was first come, first served for these events. They probably made more money off selling the t-shirts for the all
Oh,
access event on
exactly. That
their media store.
exactly, because I'm just trying to think, okay, how would they make their revenue from this thing? But yeah. As long as it kickstarted that conversation, people were talking about it in advance and during the thing, which, I remember people really enjoying it, and people really talking about this a lot, enjoying the stunt, that it works for them. It's and sometimes, and here's the difference between, you'd think that something like this is done for a film, and yet it just comes back to A24 as a brand in its own right, in the way that we don't see much of elsewhere. You think of something like that being done for a specific film, but no, they did this with their library. They did this with their older films. Like, this is A24 doing this, and again, it just comes back to the fact that you just cannot imagine anyone else being able to, do something like this, and people are being drawn to it because, oh, it's A24.
Do you think it's something that we might see more of potential in the future? Not just A24 and Neon, but some of the other studios, obviously putting sort of a ticket price on something like this, where encouraging people to get along and see a film, whether it's something like Unhinged or Films to Come, where it's like an outdoor event, maybe spaced kind of seating. I know some of the drive-in screenings in London, for example, have that element where you don't need to have a car to come along. Get people out, almost make an event, there's maybe a free t-shirt or a coupon or something involved, because the cinemas have been okay so far in the UK, but there's the potential of second lockdowns. How do you kind of make sure that you're inclusive to everyone, not just people that feel safe and confident going to cinema screens?
I mean, that's kind of, it feels like there's almost two different questions here, because, something, coming back to putting the public access, that's something that A24 put together themselves. That's not, A24 necessarily going to an exhibitor and saying, okay, let's put on a screening like this. And a lot of it comes down to, politics like that. They don't, especially, from what we've seen in the way that they have, rushed their films to VOD, they think very highly, and they want to keep the relationships going with the cinemas that, help them a ton by, having their films play widely across the US. And you can't do that without, having a good relationship. Like, they've had a traditional theatrical window on a lot of their films in the United States. There were a couple of, smaller, probably not so good titles, like something like, Slice, that ended up, going straight onto VOD.
Yeah, they had the direct TV kind of route as well, where they would sort of put on these, everyone thinks of, we talk about a lot of these great films, A24 ones, the Moonlights, the Midsummers, but then there's also these average to mediocre films that go onto this sort of direct TV
exactly,
VOD
yeah.
all around the world, all around sort of America, that people forget are A24 releases.
Yeah, exactly. And it's almost like they downplay them. And I know people have sometimes accused A24 of social media, like, why don't you give attention to, you know, to a film like that? Or, you know, most recent example, although it got, you know, more traditional run from A24, is Last Black Man in San Francisco, which is an amazing film. And, you know, whether that got its due, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say. But I think, you know, coming back to the question about, you know, events and the drive-in screenings, I think a lot of it just depends on how much you want to, you know, work and support the traditional infrastructure. Like, part of the problem here in the UK, for instance, is that none of the existing cinemas are operating their own drive-ins. Like, I think the only cinema at the moment, kind of existing, you know, indoor cinema or cinema chain that is experimenting with outdoor is actually Curzon. They opened an outdoor screening site at Camden Market in London, and they are selling tickets to screenings there, including, you know, they're about to re-release Memories of a Murder, Bong Joon-ho's breakout film, and so they're experimenting. But when it comes to drive-ins, like, it's those specific, you know, companies or cinemas, they aren't setting up, you know, pop-up drive-ins in a way that, you know, we've seen a bit of in the US. So I think in the US, again, if they're happy with, you know, not necessarily having AMC and so on and so forth, they could go for it the way that Neon the way Neon has. Internationally, it's a whole different question because that's not their area. But again, I guess my point is that it comes down to a lot of these politics, and I just hope that these politics, and I've said this, you know, before, when it comes to something like Tenet and the big films, that those politics are put aside a tiny bit. I mean, in case of independent distributors like A24, they have it a bit easier because they are willing to provide, you know, Blu-ray copies or file copies of films to cinemas, to outdoor cinemas, to community cinemas to screen. So, and a lot of pop-up venues, they wouldn't have the big digital cinema projectors that indoor cinemas do. Like, in the UK, most of the pop-up outdoor and drive-ins don't. There's only like 3 or 4 in the whole country that have that, including the one that's in London that we kind of mentioned earlier. So, and that just opens up a whole other field that I think we should be seeing more independent distributors go for. Like, an example here in the UK, again, of this is Altitude, because all of their films, they Unhinged, Stage Mother, they're about to release Rocks this weekend, the Sarah Gavron's director of Suffragettes new film. They have outdoor and drive-in screenings of those happening over the next few weeks, that because of the flexibility that's just afforded by them being independent, they don't have to worry as much about security in the way something like Tenet does. So, hopefully, in the US, you know, A24 could do something like this, but it's a very fine line to walk, especially because A24 is such a powerful brand that the conversation becomes about them. It's not, you know, say, Cinema Y puts on a drive-in screening, you know, screens A24 films. No, it's going to be A24 puts on drive-in screenings, and will the traditional players be a bit upset about that? That's all it comes down to.
I wonder if it'll just be a case that A24 really just needs to sort of see out these Los Angeles and New York lockdowns, because, you know, as you kind of touched on, for a big film like Tenet, it really relies on these big markets. But for an indie film, that seems to be where a lot of kind of the audience for their brand seems to be based. And, you know, they probably just feel that they need to see that out potentially.
Yes, yes, they do. I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, if A24 does decide, okay, we're not going to wait necessarily until New York or LA open to start releasing their films, that they start putting together, you know, special drive-in screenings. And the way, you know, for example, Disney's put up a drive-in at the Rose Bowl in LA where they screen New Mutants, while, you know, you can't see it in indoor cinemas in California, they screened what was it that they screened really recently? Yes, Nomadland. That was that was the one. They had the drive-in premiere there in LA. For all the library films, I definitely can see A24 doing something like public access again.
We touched on it, sort of their social media kind of marketing, you know, is obviously an extension of that. What's your thought with like your kind of marketing eye on sort of A24's Twitter? Because it seems to mix the classic, here's our new trailer, with sort of irreverent sort of posts and tweets and pictures of such like. What do you think of sort of what they're trying to do on Twitter and
I
Instagram?
mean, evidently it's been successful because everyone's just copying them almost. Because they were really the trendsetter, I think. I might be wrong, but they feel like the trendsetter when it comes to the idea that you do have a hyper-engaged social presence, amongst the film world anyway. Because, A24 did it, but then Amazon started doing it for a few of their titles, and the ones that really jumped out at me from the last few years, Beautiful Boy and Suspiria, where they just went all in because, of the younger fan base. That's how you speak to them. You have to always be engaged with them, like on a, replying to almost every tweet kind of level. And it takes a lot of work, and I commend any independent, smaller or independent distributor that is able to do something like that and always keep on it, 24/7. Maybe A24 at this point does have, either the staffing or the money to have a social agency, manage all of that. But yeah, it just comes back to the fact that they did set the trend for Neon to play around with it a tiny bit with, Netflix. That's the big one that's really taking this irreverent tone and hyper engagement in general. And it's just. I th It just reinforces the idea of A24 itself as a brand. That you're speaking to them. That you're speaking to them directly, you're engaging with them directly as opposed to the films themselves. The fact that we don't see many film-specific accounts for A24 films is very telling in that regard. I'd imagine obviously they'd save money a bit by not and a bit of effort in not having to set up, oh, here's a whole different website for Saint Maud, or the whole different website for Zola, or a whole different website for Uncut Gems. Like, they are not doing that. It just directly funnels through A24 channels themselves. And it's that combination of things that, are convenient from, just money, work perspective, that just happen to further the way that you're positioning yourself as a distributor and positioning your films as, and where it all starts and ends with A24 itself. And so it's just, again, it's just those things that somehow they managed to make it work. Somehow they managed to make it work.
We spoke about it earlier. They have this online store, which does come under for sort of some criticism for their pricing. But do you feel sort of with their store that they're sort of they're kind of similarities with a place like Mondo, for example, that they're creating it as a boutique brand, that the t-shirts, there's only so many of them, or poster prints, there's only 500, and once they're kind of gone, for example. Obviously that kind of pricing, you know, for putting a little A24 logo on a t-shirt for like $40 and then fees on top of that. Do you think that's quite deliberate, obviously creating this sort of boutique nature around their sort of store and sort of keeping that kind of younger audience, I guess?
Well, I think, I mean, I'm sure something like Mondo is a bit of a comp, a comparable for them. So, like, they try and model themselves, of others that have done this successfully. But I think this does speak to a larger point, though. This speaks to a larger point of the way that A24 has decided to engage younger audiences as an independent distributor. And the way that it is decided comes back to the way, because we think of merch stores outside of, film specifically, music. That's how it's been done. You'd have overpriced merchandise for your favorite bands. You'd have connected to specific albums that they release. Obviously, when bands or musicians go on tour, that they sell this stuff there. And what I think, A24's approach, and that is the sort of approach that a lot of distributors or companies within the film space ended up taking. And that extends to even just the way that fandom works today. It's the way that fandom and engagement with younger audiences has worked most specifically, I think, in music, because you have this cult, almost cult-like devotion to a particular artist, and how and you manage to generate money off it, obviously with merchandise. You always try and engage with your fan base directly, and that's the sort of thing that A24, you know, has borrowed for establishing their brand, and then set the trend for for a lot of other companies in the film space to do the same. So I think in some ways it's justified because, you know, that's the way that they've modeled it, and it evidently seems to be working.
One of the things we kind of touched on earlier was sort of how they kind of operate with something like Uncut Gems, for example. A24 seem to have an approach which has proven to be somewhat hit or miss for them. You think of the huge success of something like Moonlight, and then the kind of quote unquote failure for something like Uncut Gems, with when they approach Oscar and kind of campaigns and so on, where instead of sort of, you know, they spend their money trying to folk back one horse, some cases like Moonlight last year, Uncut Gems, and Uncut Gems, for example, completely fell apart, no nominations whatsoever. I think everyone hoped and maybe expected Adam Sandler would receive a nomination. But how do you think about this kind of campaign they have where they sort of release sort of several kind of quote unquote Oscar contenders sort of tail end of the year, like a lot of people do, but then they sort of get behind one horse, you know, to the expense of say something like Waves, which when I saw that at LFF last year, I thought I can see nominations and cinematography awards for a film like this, and then it just gets kind of blanked out of like, okay, it didn't do kind of too well at sort of opening weekend and sort of selected areas. Uncut Gems is the horse we're backing out. What do you think of that approach? Is it valid? Is it sort of doomed to failure? And should A24 be spreading the sort of money when it comes to these kind of campaigns?
I think there's a certain limitation, there's a certain ceiling that when you have an independent distributor like A24, you know, spending money on Oscar campaigns, there's only so much that they can spend. While at the same time, they're within those limitations, they're trying to do what a big studio does and have, you know, several, like almost a whole slate of Oscar titles. And so to have, you know, that they start to just back one horse eventually, I think there's no surprise because God, we have to remember A24 isn't a major studio. They only have a certain limited amount of money each year to put towards Oscar and awards campaigns. We have to be mindful of that. And so, and yet in their actions, they try to be more like a major studio, and that's and you know, awards is one of the things that they have tried to be kind of more mainstream and do it the way, you know, Focus Features, again, as I mentioned, that's Universal. Searchlight, that's obviously, you know, 20th Century, that's Disney. So it's a it feels like when you think it through like that, it feels like a logical consequence that unfortunately, you know, stuff like that ends up happening. And then sometimes a film like Uncut Gems, as much as it deserved recognition, like is it really an Oscar film? Is it an Oscar film? You know, maybe if a distributor like Searchlight or Focus or you know, Netflix, although ironically Netflix obviously had it in elsewhere, where that they may have been able to just push it through with brute force and just money, 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 because with awards campaigns and with awards like the Oscars, that's what it's campaigns. It's all about campaigns. That's what it comes down to, I think. But just to kind of, you know, move away from awards, I think it's important when we're talking about failures to also talk about, I think, the most controversial aspect when it comes to A24, it's the way that they've handled their horror titles. Because if we talk about stuff like The Witch or Hereditary or Midsommar, or, you know, obviously Say Mourn hasn't come out yet, but we have to see what happens there. Like all, you know, really critically acclaimed films. But then when they come out, particularly in the US, they might not perform so well, and the word of mouth isn't particularly good. Like, oh, it's not as scary in traditional horror. And you know, when we think of the phrase that a lot of people on film Twitter seem to hate, which is elevated horror, that's very much associated with A24's horror films. And I think it's something worth debating and exploring, because you know, how do you get films like that out to a more mainstream audience? Because that's But that's another thing where, you know, A24 is trying to be more mainstream, more, you know, akin to a mainstream big studio rather than focusing on, okay, you know, art house independent, so that's New York and LA, not particularly, you know, middle America, it wouldn't really play well there. Like they're trying to go what their biggest market release marketing and distribution efforts seem to be with those horror films, but then sometimes they just end up falling flat in their face when it comes to general audiences, and whether there's really a way to resolve that, it's I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how Saint Maud ends up performing whenever it comes out in the States, because you could tell that, you know, with that film specifically, because, you know, it of the British association with it and the British independent cred that it has. And I was looking back at the trailer, comparing the A24 trailers for it and the Studio Canal trailers for it. And you can tell with the Studio Canal UK materials that they've gone a bit more kind of in the art house direction. They focused really a lot on the reviews, on the acclaim, while A24 goes way more into the genre territory, almost, you know, what we end up seeing regularly with you know, something like that's another one I think I forgot to mention. It Comes at Night. That is such a big example of a marketing campaign that made the film look a lot scarier and more. There was more to it in terms of, you know, people expecting something more, you know, horror-y, like what is actually happening there than there actually was in the film. In the film itself, you know, it's a beautiful meditation on, you know, on grief and family, but the way that the marketing's being presented is almost completely different.
I had a quick look there at the sort of the box office for A24 films. So their top 10 is The Disaster Artist with 21 million at the US
Understandably.
box office. This obviously combines the kind of worldwide box office. Spring Breakers 31 worldwide, 14 domestic. Room 36 worldwide, 14 domestic. Ex Machina 38 worldwide, 25 domestic. The Witch, the horror movie, start to kind of make the prevalence there. 40 million worldwide, 25 domestic. Midsummer 46 worldwide, 27 domestic. 50 million worldwide and 50 million domestic for Uncut Gems. I don't know how that necessarily works out there. Moonlight 65 worldwide, 27 domestic. Lady Bird 78 with domestic 48, and then Hereditary at number one with 81 worldwide and 44 at the domestic kind of box office. So sort of the horror somehow still manages to kind of just creep up sort of in that top 10 with things like It Comes at Night just outside the top 10, Lighthouse as well kind of at 14. It's quite interesting sort of looking at their totals outside the world.
Yeah, and again, I think a lot of credit obviously has to go to the distributors handling those films in those countries, who ended up obviously handling it. I mean, it's no surprise that something like Lady Bird is up there because, of course, that's Universal, that's a major studio release everywhere else. But the what I was talking about here, I think, is, you know, specifically kind of the US. It's down to word of mouth, because you have to, you know, we're like digging into. You know, sure, it may have done a great opening weekend, but then what happens in week two and week three when people find out that, oh, you know, maybe Midsommar's a breakup movie? I mean, I think it's nice that, you know, in a lot of those films, there's been a few cases of where, you know, obviously the critical acclaim has, you know, won out in this case, and people have, you know, recognized that, oh, it's a great film. But, like, I think it's just something like every single time when we get an A24 horror, you get those complaints coming up from, you know, people outside of, you know, film Twitter. About like, oh, it's not scary.
Yeah, we've spoke about it a little bit with things like kind of Neon, for example. Do you think sort of like in the past sort of year, for example, I think the past in sort of 2019, for example, I thought A24 had their strongest kind of slate of consistent, you know, good films. How do you feel sort of Neon after sort of the success of something like Parasite, for example, you know, the huge
Yeah.
Oscar wins, the huge publicity for something like that. Do you think sort of A24 could eventually be sort of left behind by something like Neon with sort of like these kind of big acclaim? Or is something like Parasite similar to A24's Moonlight an outlier that kind of rose to the top where a lot of their films, whether it's, we spoke about it earlier, the name just escaped me, I'm going to kill, I'm going to die tomorrow or something like that. And, you know, other similar genre films, which will never sort of have the huge kind of breakthrough with the public. Where do you sort of see that balance just now with these two kind of indie names? Obviously, I feel they're going to complement each other, but it feels that there's sort of an interesting kind of crossroads with each other.
Yeah, because, you know, Neon obviously, you know, started as a distributor, obviously sometime later than A24, but you can see that they've, A24's discovered and found this sort of kind of niche when it comes to the indie world, that you can, you know, have independent films that appeal to kind of slightly more genre-y, slightly younger audience, and it's something that Neon really plays with as well. And I think it is a pretty good comparison, you know, Moonlight and Moonlight in Paris, obviously, because both won Best Picture, both, you know, very similar distributors in terms of taste. It does come down to, you know, really eclectic taste, but then the key difference I think between them is that I don't think Neon's trying to be this brand, this actual, you know, big people go to a Neon film because it's a Neon film. Like, did people go to Parasite because it's a Neon film? People went to Parasite because it was Bong Joon-ho. And because of the acclaim that's been building up for long. I think with A24, the fact that they are a brand is probably both a blessing and a curse. And I wouldn't be surprised if that may end up meaning that, you know, there isn't such a focus on the films themselves. And therefore, the films themselves might not be performing as well as they could. Because it all depends on where the audience is. If the audience is really all about, you know, having brands in specific places to go for specific types of films, then, you know, A24's approach there is a winner. But if it's all about the content, if it's all about the film itself that's being released, then potentially that's where they could get left behind. So it's going to be a very interesting one to watch, because yeah, as we've you know, spoken about previously, A24 is probably the only distributor, you know, even be it, you know, among the major studios, where it's a specific brand in its own right.
Well, thank you so much for joining me, Anton. It's been an absolute kind of pleasure to tap your brain to kind of get the a kind of specialist kind of view on something like this. For people that are listening to this and want to hear your thoughts on things like kind of Christopher Nolan, box office, James Bond trailers, where's kind of the best places to read, download, follow you online? And I must say, I really enjoyed your podcast with Scott Mendelson. He's someone I love to follow on Twitter, and I thought you two coming together to talk about the DC event was quite amusing, especially his sort of unique involvement on the day as well.
Yeah, thank you. Or Trailer Track is really the best way. You can follow Trailer Track at Trailer Track on Twitter, and the website is trailer-track.com, and you can find the podcast there and kind of everything that's been going on in and around the website, and particularly, you know, make sure to follow the website on Twitter, because that's where a lot of the engagement ends up happening. And I must say, you know, it really comes, the fact that I am so engaged on the Twitter specifically, I think, you know, A24 and others, you know, finding that success in that sort of approach, I mean, that's kind of impacted me a bit as well.
Well, it's been a real pleasure, Anton, and hopefully we can have you maybe back on again in the future. So thank you so much. It's been fantastic to chat with you at last.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.